Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is now time for the third case that we'll be hearing this morning on our oral argument calendar, which I'll call while you're settling in there, Council. Our third case is Brenda Lutzky versus Metropolitan Council et al., case A220194. And before we dive into your arguments, one thing that I'm hoping that Council for Respondent can address this morning in its argument is the motion that we received this morning to accept a late-filed reply brief. And specifically, the court would like to know whether respondent would like to file a written response. So perhaps you could address that during your oral argument this morning. I just want to give you a few words about our procedures here this morning, and then we can begin the arguments. Council, you know that both sides get 15 minutes to present their cases, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please identify yourself and the party you're representing before we begin with, before you begin your argument. We're making a recording, an audio recording of the arguments this morning, which will be available shortly on the court's website. With that, I think we're ready to go. Counsel for appellant, one last thing that I should mention, you're free to make your argument wherever you want. As you can see, you have many options here. This center, I think it's technically a lectern and not a podium, has the time displayed on it, if you would prefer that. If you are more concerned about distancing, please feel free to use the lectern closest to you. You may proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the court, my name is Carl Christensen. I do want to start off by thanking the court for considering our late filed motion. I also want to apologize for the circumstances upon which we made that motion. As you can see from the affidavit, it was just a complete blunder on our part. But again, I appreciate your indulgence on that. We're here today because the question before the court is whether respondents should be liable for the theft of a laptop and the theft of files that contained protected health information of my clients and other employees of Metro Transit and of the Met Council. The brief facts that are important to touch on are that on May 19th, 2019, Tanisha Brown, an employee of respondents, parked her vehicle at a St. Paul strip mall. Both her employee-used laptop and completed physical files that contained medical information were left in her vehicle while Brown went shopping. While she was shopping, those items were stolen. Her testimony was that she returned to the car and the trunk was open and there was no signs of forced entry. It is undisputed, at least for the purposes of Met Council's representations, that there was protected medical information on the files, and there's an open question of whether or not there was protected medical information on the laptop. One of the things I point out in the brief is that the district court made factual findings that are inconsistent with the record and do go to the issues that are before the court here today. There's two factual findings that are not supported, or at least there's a question of fact, are that the vehicle was locked when this occurred. You heard me say earlier that the testimony of Ms. Brown was that she returned to the vehicle and the trunk was open and there was no signs of forced entry. The other factual finding was that she was en route from her office to the Haywood Center where they store these files at the time that she took a detour. That's not the case. This was a frolic. On a Sunday, she went to do her laundry and may or may not have been working from the laundromat. And then
Mr. Christensen, if I can.
Yes.
And I understand what you're saying about those factual findings, but aren't those don't those factual findings only become relevant at all if we find that there's no immunity?
Sure.
Right. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. You're not saying that that somehow relates to the immunity arguments here.
Well, it does, and I'll get to that in a minute, but it relates to it in the sense of what was the underlying government act conduct that we have to first look at when we're looking at either statutory immunity or common law immunity. The threshold question is, what is going on?
Doesn't that, though, only come up if we're talking about the common law immunity, not the statutory immunity? I don't see how those facts fit into the statutory immunity analysis, because I thought you were saying that, you know, it's their failure to implement safeguards for the health records when they're in transit for storage or in connection with working from home. Isn't that your statutory immunity claim?
Yeah, my understanding of the law is that both considerations do ask first to look at what is the conduct, and then what. And so for the statutory, go ahead, Judge.
But isn't the conduct here the policy? You know, well, no. Go ahead. You frame up the conduct we should be looking at for me.
So let's talk about statutory immunity first. So statutory immunity is the general principle under Chapter 5, I believe it is that there is tort liability against government employees. There's an exception, and that exception is when, and this is what gets to statutory immunity, when the conduct actually, that is the conduct that may give rise to the immunity, is actually something of such a level that it's a policy decision from the legislative or the executive branch. And so here, we don't have those facts. And the district court is clearly wrong on a statutory immunity case, because what we have here is a determination of how to safeguard protected data when an employee is not at work, specifically when she's actually running personal errands. And so there's a balancing test that's required, and that balancing test looks at what are the actually policy considerations that are weighed in terms of making the actual policy that was the source, the conduct that I'm describing is then what is the conduct that is the source of the immunity. So for statutory immunity, the first question is, what is the conduct, and what is the balancing that the legislative or the executive branch undertook to come to whatever the policy is? And in this case, it's hard to even get there.
I thought,
yes,
and this is where I want you to, because I'm focused on the conduct too, I thought you were saying it's Met Council's failure to implement safeguards for health records, that's the conduct we ought to be looking at. Am I wrong about that?
Yes.
When it comes to statutory immunity.
Yes, our argument is the conduct is protecting the data while on a personal errand. That is the conduct. And where that argument plays in is related to the common law immunity and the vicarious immunity. The failure to promulgate policies to proscribe that conduct would go to whether or not they can claim vicarious common law liability. And so the case laws, I'm skipping ahead here, but just to follow with the judge's question, there's also common law immunity, and that would be basically where state actors or employees, government employees, are acting at a policy level, on an operational level, such that we don't want to have them to question their own conduct when they have to make a determination based on policy. And so the question becomes, is this a decision that falls under this operational level consideration, or is it purely ministerial? And the cases that say it's ministerial are cases that relate to teachers' conduct in teaching in a classroom, a teacher's conduct related to a saw blade in a shop class, and also other conduct. And what they say there is that the consideration there is what is the underlying what is the level of the policy? And then getting now to the question is and even if you find that there's common law immunity, the question then is, are the respondents also, can they invoke themselves of a vicarious immunity through that? And the case on point that says they can't, it's relevant to our case, is the SW case. And in that case, that was a case about a sexual assault of a girl in a school where they had a number of policies that they promulgated. It stands for both statutory immunity and for common law immunity. But what they said was that the policies they promulgated weren't enough for them to actually claim that they could be they could claim vicarious liability. There's an absence of policies, and that finally gets to your question. So the absence of policies, even if we can find that there is an activity in an operational level that was being addressed for immunity under the common law, then the absence of policy says that they're not available, the vicarious liability wouldn't be available to them.
Okay.
That's a very long answer to your question.
And now I'm going to ask you another one.
Oh, great. Oh, I love this. Keep going.
So I think what the Met Council is saying is, well, we have policies to safeguard health records. Maybe they just don't precisely address this issue, but we have the broad policies. So the parameters of our policy, that's policymaking. And that's the way they should look at it, as opposed to, oh, like an SW, just did they not have a policy at all? So could you help me with that? Because that's what I'm struggling with. Are we just talking about, oh, is the Met Council, did they maybe get it wrong or right about the parameters of the security policy? Or did they just not even have a policy for working at home employees, for an example, at all?
I'll answer that in reverse order. They have three policies that we're talking about in this case. The two that we spent a lot of time on the ones that they claim are the policies that cover this. It's a policy related to data security and basically password maintenance. Tips like don't leave your passwords under your keyboard on a piece of paper. There is a third policy, which is Exhibit 43. We reference their interrogatory responses related to it, but we don't pinpoint the actual exhibit in there. But it's that one says that's related to the stolen devices. And that says due to their high value and portability, laptop computers and other small electronic devices are highly susceptible to theft. Metropolitan employees and consultants in possession of council-owned electronic devices are responsible for the protection of that equipment from theft or damage. The high value and portability technology make them particularly susceptible to theft or loss and require the highest degree of care. So that's not much of a policy because the rest of that talks about what to do if theft happens. It doesn't say anything like, do not leave your laptops in a car. And we're saying that in today's day and age, when all you need to do is go to a parking lot and see a sign that says, do not leave valuables and belongings in your vehicle, the court can take notice of the fact that that is not really a policy that addresses the issue that happened. So the issue is not the promulgation of policies necessarily. The issue is there's no policy related to leaving a laptop and files in a car.
So, what about policies governing treatment of paper records?
The policies regarding paper records, there are none as far as we know. The three I cited to all deal with electronic data. So we haven't talked about policies related to paper records at all. I don't think there's anything in the record. So now, weaving back through the immunity considerations, going back to statutory immunity, what was the balancing that was undertaken by the state here to come up with whatever the policy is? That's an impossible question to answer because we don't know what the policy is. And surely the choice that Ms. Brown was faced with is something as simple as, do I leave the laptop in my car or do I take it with me? And that's not enough of a determination or discourse to be policy level weighing and measuring of the factors, the economic, the social and the other factors that should be, the case law says, should be weighed to get to a statutory immunity defense. Nor is Ms. Brown's determination to leave the laptop in the car such a high level decisional process that this court shouldn't put its determinations onto that because it's impeding or it's intruding into the domain of another governmental branch. So clearly this isn't an issue of statutory immunity and the lower court should be reversed on that. So what we're left with is common law immunity. And we get back to the similar consideration, and that is, what is the policy and on what level did that policy come? Is this purely ministerial? Did she come up with a decision that was part of the facts and the matter of her everyday work environment and make a decision based on that? Or was she relying on something of a higher operational level for the business and making a decision to leave the laptop in the car? And I would argue that this is even more ministerial than the SW case, more ministerial than the teacher case, I can't remember the name of, and more ministerial than the Larson case, that's the one with the shop teacher and the blade guard missing from the saw. Here, there have actually, what would the policy position be for leaving a laptop in a car? Judge Regis opined that it was secure whether the car was locked or not. We would respectfully disagree. In today's day and age, no one should believe that leaving a laptop in a car is secure, and it's surely not as secure as keeping it on your person. In fact, what is put in exhibit...
Is there evidence in the record that you submitted on that point? I mean, what are you basing that on?
Basing what on?
That having it on your person while you're out and about is safer than leaving it in your trunk.
Well, I think
that's
that,
not in evidence, is it? That's all I'm trying to get at.
That's an argument, and I think it comports with what's set out in Exhibit 43, which is that it says that they must take the highest degree of care to prevent theft. So my argument was begging the question at the time this decision was made. Ms. Brown should have asked herself, what is the highest degree of care? Now, going on to the last question of vicarious liability, can Met Council, if Ms. Brown is found to have immunity under the common law, should that immunity extend to Metropolitan Council? And our answer is also no, for the reasons I gave before. Excuse me, I'm laboring under a cold, and as I get excited, I don't have all my breathing faculties working correctly, so.
Take a deep breath.
You'll I need to take
good.
A breath. we would say no because of the absence of any policy that addresses this particular issue. You have something that the security is of the utmost care. It's information that is protected by statute, two different statutes we cite to, the relevant one that we have a cause, and the other one, the Data Privacy Act, that sets out a standard for reasonableness related to protecting data. And the third thing is, the computer itself is valuable. I mean, there's other reasons that Ms. Brown could have come to the right result by just looking at what was in her car. She didn't need to know. I see my time is up. May I finish my point?
Go ahead and finish your
point. She didn't need to know that there was a statutory regime that protected data. All she needed to know is that there was a valuable laptop in her trunk.
Thank you. And I just will say before you sit down, I'm hoping you can address the final issues in the case as well, perhaps in your rebuttal.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kate Baxterkoff, and I'm here on behalf of Defendant Metropolitan Council and its operating division, Metro Transit. We respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's decision to grant summary judgment in favor of the council. As an initial matter, you had asked me to address the question of accepting the late reply brief. I don't believe that the council needs to file a response to that motion. I presume that you all have the reply brief. We did not know it was rejected, so it did not affect any of our preparations or anything like that for today.
Thank you.
As an initial matter, in order to reverse the district court and overturn the grant of summary judgment, this court needs to find not only that the council is not entitled to statutory immunity and not entitled to common law immunity, but also that the plaintiff has stated a claim that has a genuine issue of material fact for all of the elements on either a Minnesota Health Records Act claim or a negligence claim. And at this stage, even if this court were to determine that the council is not entitled to statutory or common law immunity, which we believe they should, and I'll address momentarily, the plaintiff does not address the negligence, all of the elements of a negligence claim or all of the elements of a Minnesota Health Records Act claim and the arguments that the council made in its briefing, which means that this court can easily conclude that the council is not a person for the purposes of the Minnesota Health Records Act, which is not an argument that's argued in either the opening or the reply brief of the plaintiff, and that that there is no health record at issue for Ms. Lutzky, and that there is no foreseeability for a negligence claim and no damages for either a Minnesota Health Records Act claim or a negligence claim.
I mean, just while you're talking about that, but yes, would you agree, Ms. Baxter-Koff, that if we address the issue about whether the Met Council is a person under the statute, whether the form was a health record, and at least whether there was release, those would be, we don't have clear precedent on those issues, you know, those, I mean, you would be asking us to, if we reach those issues and found their immunity, those would be precedential issues, right?
So on the question of whether, I think that's true for some issues and not others. So on the question of whether the council is a person under the Minnesota Health Records Act, we cite two non-precedential cases, but there is not precedential case law on that question. And on the question of damages, I think Adams versus Harpstead is precedential and would indicate that if there's only an emotional distress damages claim for either negligence or the Minnesota Health Records Act, that they have not established evidence for that claim.
Right, but not the health record of release issue. Those would be my three questions.
Yes.
I think that's
correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Now, so on the question of statutory immunity, the council is entitled to discretionary act immunity, which immunizes municipalities from a claim based on the performance or failure to perform a discretionary function or duty, whether or not the discretion is abused, in this case, for planning level conduct. There are a number of policies and procedures at issue, some of which the plaintiff talked about and some of which they did not. So first, there is an overarching information security policy that directed employees to be proactive in exercising responsibility to manage and protect information to protect confidentiality. Second, that comprehensive language undoubtedly covers any situation where a council employee is handling information belonging to the council at work, working at home, working over the weekend, working at the laundromat. Second, the council had security measures in place to protect information that was stored on laptops. That included requiring that they be password protected, that they had encryption, that they were set to log off, all of that kind of information, all of that, those procedures. Third, the council had specific procedures and policies related to paper and electronic records of daily drug testing results, which are the paper forms, only one of which related to Ms. Lutzky, and which was an employment verification form. Drug tests have to be scanned. They have to be transported from the place where they're received in the mail to the Haywood building, which is where they're stored for the Met Council. And there were, in fact, procedures based on that, and also requirements under the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations for dealing with employment verification forms. And then there were also policies and procedures in place related to responding to thefts and how to report lost devices and how to know things happened.
Would you agree that there were not specific policies to address the safeguards for health records when they were in transit for storage, the paper ones, or in connection with working from home?
I would agree that there is not a specific policy that says that you cannot put a piece of information in the trunk of your car. I believe it is covered by the overarching policy, and that distinction between the overarching policies and a specific directive that the plaintiff wishes were in place for the council is exactly the type of discretionary immunity that the case law talks about as being protected, and the kind of second guessing that this court does not wish to do of council prerogatives. So if you read appellant's brief and listen to the argument that he made today, what they want is for the court to write the policy for the council to address retroactively the situation that happened to this particular employee. And the case law that we cite and an overarching of it, it says that that's exactly the kind of situation where statutory immunity is appropriate because it is the kind of decision that should be left to the council and not to particular plaintiffs afterwards looking backwards. I think I will say I don't think that there is a dispute in the factual record about what it is that Ms. Brown was doing on the weekend. I do think that the district court inadvertently phrased the timeline of it a little bit wrong, but I don't think that the parties disagree on what happened, which is that, or that the record is unclear about it in any way, which is that Ms. Brown went home on Friday afternoon. She had records, paper records, and her employee-issued laptop in the trunk of her car. She took them home to work on them. On Sunday morning, they were locked in the trunk of her car when she left. I don't think that's a discretionary thing. I think trunks just lock. She was going to the laundromat on Sunday in order to do her laundry and work on her and do work. She stopped at a thrift store in the interim, and things were taken while she was doing that. It is true she was not directly en route to the Haywood building. She was planning to go there Monday morning. And I don't believe that's relevant to anything, but well, just FYI.
Here's where it comes, you know, where this gives me some pause. Mm-hmm. And that's really what, particularly if we get to official, vicarious official immunity.
Yep.
We're focusing on Ms. Brown's conduct. You know, is it a discretionary or is it her conduct in deciding to go into the thrift store before she presumably takes her laptop to work in the laundromat, mm-hmm. okay? Is that a discretionary decision or an operational decision? And discretionary decisions, as I understand it, are ones involving individual professional judgment. How is a decision to go into a thrift store and leave your laptop in your car, how is that a professional judgment? That seems that strikes me as hard to understand.
So I think there are two different issues going on here. So with common law immunity, the first question is whether or not the conduct at issue was operational, involving professional judgment, or ministerial, meaning that it was directed by someone else. And then the second is whether or not her conduct was in the scope of her employment. And I don't think the question is whether or not she was engaged in professional judgment to go into a thrift store. I think it was she was engaged in professional judgment to leave items in the trunk of her car while she did anything. So they were locked in the trunk of her car. She made the affirmative act to press the key fob and lock the car in and of itself. She thought that she was protecting the information. Regardless of whether something happened with the trunk or there was an accident or it got opened, the only uncontroverted evidence in the record is that she believed that she was protecting her vehicle when leaving to do anything else. The same is true anytime you put anything in a vehicle or any other location. And the information security policy and the data protection policy issued by the Met Council gave her the discretion to decide how to implement those policies. Whether that was the absolute smartest decision she could have made at any given moment isn't the standard. It's just, is it within the zone of where she was permitted to figure out what she should be doing with that information? Right? I think the second question is there is a line of cases that the plaintiff cites in their briefing and that we talk about in our briefing, talking about what happens if the conduct at issue is outside the scope of your employment. So I think the relevant question is going into the thrift store outside of the scope of her employment so far that she's no longer entitled to that protection and then the Met Council does not get vicarious liability. I don't think I think that in this situation, that focusing only on the going into the thrift store is too narrow of a view of what the conduct at issue was, which is that we know that she was entitled to work on the weekend, and in fact she had to work on the weekend because the council gets drug and alcohol test results whenever they come in, and if a drug or alcohol test comes back positive, then the council has to take a bus driver off the line immediately. You can't have someone who failed a drug test drive a public bus. And so she had to be working on the weekend. She had to have her laptop. She had to have these documents. Those documents had to be moved from the building that she worked in, which is one council location, to the Haywood building where you store paper records, and where they had to store paper records because chain of custody forms come in paper forms and they're stapled together and there's a lot of different pieces. And so they had policies in place that said, we keep those in part so that because the scanning's not always easy to read, right? And so her decision to work on the weekend was fully within the scope of both her job and her ability of how to decide to do that was a discretionary act that she could decide what to do. So to leave her things in the car while she did anything, i.e. while she went into her apartment, if she parked on the street, while she went anywhere over the weekend is part of the functions of her job and is an operational level conduct that should be protected, in our view. I will also note, the council doesn't need to be immune on both counts. They only need to be immune one way or the other. The district court found that the council was entitled to both statutory and common law immunity. But if this court determined that the council was entitled to statutory immunity but not common law immunity, you would still affirm summary judgment for the council. I think that that is all of the common law based immunity arguments that they that the plaintiff raised. I think that this is not ministerial conduct in the sense that the case law talks about it, because ministerial conduct is conduct that's directed by someone else. So it's conduct that says you have to, you know, your lesson plan needs to say X, or you have to be in this room from this time period to this time period. And none of that is at issue here. It's uncontested that she had a job that involved working on the weekend and that she was permitted to take her laptop home in order to do that and to take physical file folders home to do that, because part of her job was taking the physical files and entering them into a program on the computer in order to maintain the records for them. In order to be successful on a Minnesota, or I guess I'm going to talk about the Health Records Act claim and the negligence claim, unless you all have other questions about this. So in order to maintain a Minnesota Health Records Act claim, the plaintiff has to be a genuine issue of material fact that a person released a health record that led to consequential damages. Our argument is that there is no vicarious common law or vicarious liability, too many vicariouses and immunities, available to the council or available to the plaintiff for this, which means that because they did not name the employee as a defendant, that this claim is not available. We don't believe there's a genuine issue of material fact that any information was released, because the theft is not released in sort of an analogous situation to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, and that the only piece of information that was at issue for Ms. Lutzky is not a health record, because it was an unfilled out form that contained her name and her social security number and no other information. And this court has held
Is there a factual issue about that, given how the council in its initial notices to folks, characterized it?
I don't believe so. So the notice that got sent to Ms. Lutzky says the council is aware of a theft incident involving drug and alcohol test results. The information,
and those would be health records.
Those may be health records. Yes, the information that was released related to you is your name and your social security number. I don't believe that that information is unclear. I don't believe that that creates a genuine issue of material fact that says that there was a health record for her released, especially when all of the discovery in the case indicates that there is a list of documents that were at issue. She had one issue. It was an unfilled out employment verification form that may have been a health record had they filled it out, but was not filled out until afterwards, and that the chronology for that is clear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you may go ahead with any rebuttal you have when you're ready.
Thank you. I'm going to start on that last point and then circle back to Your Honor's question about the other issues in this case. The letter that Ms. Lutzky received clearly indicated that her health records were compromised. The court can look at it itself, but my recollection, looking for my notes on that, 66 individuals had data breached that related to their drug and alcohol testing results, date of birth, and phone numbers. 10 individuals had data breach related to their social security numbers and drug and alcohol testing results. And 5 individuals had data breach related to their social security numbers, date of birth, drug and alcohol testing results, and phone numbers. So all of them had drug and alcohol testing results. There is an issue of fact of what was contained, and part of the one of the issues also before the district court was that we had brought a motion to compel to try to get to what was actually on the computer. So there's still an open issue. If this court reverses, we want to go back and revisit that motion to compel, because we think there's all of the information is focused on the files, but we don't have a definitive answer what was on the laptop. And that's one of the open questions before the district court at the combined motion to compel summary judgment motion. Now, on the other issues that respondents lay out, whether or not they are a person, that's a question that the lower court didn't take up. That was an argument presented to it, and it didn't address it because it thought it had alternative grounds to get to the same result. We do point out that the interpretive statutes say that a person is a governmental entity, a corporation, an LLC, or any other putative entity. And that's in our reply, but I don't think that question is before this court. I addressed no health records at issue and foreseeability. That's also not an issue that came before the district court. I don't think we need to spend too much time on that. The idea that it's not foreseeable that you leave a computer in a car that's going to get stolen. I'll let the court make a determination of that on its own. The two remaining issues then are whether or not there was a release of information. Respondent's argument is that theft is not a release. And our argument, mostly on policy grounds, is that it has to be a release, right? If a volitional act to give information out that wasn't allowed to be given out as prescribed by the act, why would an unvolitional or involuntary act or an act that was an intervening third party that allows the release, why would that not be prescribed by the act? And our point for that is, if that's the case, it incentivizes what we have here today, the failure to promulgate policies to protect.
How do you distinguish this court's Smallwood case on that issue?
Well, Smallwood, first of all, was looking only at sovereign immunity. And it says this case is only about sovereign immunity. And most of Smallwood's analysis has to do with the Data Practices Act and promulgation. But it does actually make a determination that entity is not a person. In that instance, it was the Department of Corrections. I think it's wrong on that. And the interpretive statutes say that, I believe, fairly prescribe.
It is a precedential opinion of this court.
It is. And we maintain in our brief, and I maintain to you here today, that the interpretive statutes come to a different result. So I say it's wrong. It's wrong on the law. And in fact, the fact that person is somehow limited in this statute only to a natural person, while it's not that way for the application of any other statute, is a result that I think should be clarified by this court. So I believe theft of medical records is a release, clearly is a release, and there's a public policy reason for that, because we want to protect this information. We want to incentivize the protection of the information and not let people be lax and allow intervening third parties to do what they can't do without direct direction of the source of those records. The last thing is whether or not we've adequately pled damages to maintain either claim. Our argument is under the data or the Health Records Act, we don't need actual damages to maintain a claim there. It says we're entitled to compensatory damages plus attorney's fees. But we do also maintain that there is an allocution of damages. First would be credit reporting, which we stylize as, I see my time is up, may I complete my point?
Go ahead and complete your point.
That we stylize as compensatory damages, but also the allegations of emotional distress is enough to meet the mark to allow it to be presented to a jury. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time today.
Thank you both so much for your oral arguments this morning, which were very helpful to the court. The case is now with us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. Take care.